read by Jane Royce.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has been defending her first budget, insisting achieving economic growth is her number one mission. On Wednesday, Ms Reeves announced £40 billion of tax rises, including increases to employers' national insurance contributions and changes to inheritance tax to pay for investment in public services. In an interview with the BBC's Laura Koonsberg, Ms Reeves insisted raising employer national insurance hadn't been on the agenda before the election, but claimed the previous government had cut employee contributions without the money to pay for it. The new Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, says she believes raising national insurance will make people poorer and will not result in growth. On Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, Ms Badenoch also acknowledged that the Tory party had got a lot of things wrong and that standards had slipped. UNICEF says Palestinian children in Gaza will continue to die unless Israel is held to account. Earlier, the agency reported that 50 children had been killed in Israeli airstrikes in 48 hours in Jabalia. The area has come under intense bombardment for weeks. Israel says it's trying to prevent Hamas from regrouping. Spain's king and queen have arrived in the flood-hit Valencia region as more soldiers are deployed to help with the recovery effort. The Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, has mobilised 10,000 extra troops after criticism of a slow response by local officials. Spain's meteorological agency says more rain is on the way. Officials in Pakistan will close primary schools for a week in Lahore because of record levels of air pollution. The country's second biggest city has been covered in smog for several days. The World Health Organization said the pollution is more than 80 times over the level considered acceptable. More than 130 organisations, green groups and sporting bodies are expected to come together in central London today in support of clean water. Campaigners want the government to take tougher action in order to keep the UK's rivers and seas clean. The government says it's launched a review into the entire water sector. The weather, mild, largely dry and settled with cloud for many. There'll be the odd spot of drizzle in places. Temperatures will reach 15 Celsius in London, 14 in Cardiff and 13 in Belfast and Edinburgh. BBC News at 2 minutes past 12. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Brian Ferry has been a very familiar voice for more than 50 years as the co-founder of Roxy Music and as a solo artist and songwriter. When Roxy Music first appeared on Top of the Pops in 1972, millions of viewers suddenly saw something new, an extravagantly dressed band featuring an early synthesizer, an oboe, and Brian leading from an upright piano wearing a sparkling black and green jacket. In the words of one critic, this one definitely arrived from planet Mars. It was a bold early statement, launching a career which has produced 24 studio albums and numerous international hits. Brian's most recent release, Retrospective, draws on his deep back catalogue and includes a new version of Dylan's 1965 song, She Belongs to Me. Well, no Bob Dylan in your choice today, Brian, but you have brought us jazz with Charlie Parker, Mahler, Elgar, Prokofiev. But I think we're going to start with a Stabat Mater. Why this?
Well, I like the voice of James Bowman, the countertenor. I like voices up there. And such a beautiful sound. And a great old friend of mine loved James Bowman's voice. And so I always think of my friend Jeremy when I hear this. And that's beautiful singing.
It's a very beautiful sound, isn't it, singing in the falsetto? And it has a kind of analogy to quite a lot of pop singing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, probably the first music I ever heard or ever listened to was a vocal group called The Ink Spots. When I was 5 years old, my Auntie Enid used to play it to me endlessly, a bunch of 78s, which I still have, actually. The lead singer had a wonderful high voice. They were a great influence on Elvis Presley, actually, The Ink Spots.
Fascinating that there are these connections between two art forms that lots of people think are miles apart, but I don't think they are, really.
It's all connected, really, I think.
It's either good or bad.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is pretty good. It's amazing the way he uses those suspensions, one note clashing against its neighbour, and then the neighbour dropping away.
It's very haunting, the whole thing. It's so beautiful. It's so precise and refined and delicate, and I think it sounds great.
And the combination of those two textures, the soprano and the countertenor, which also kind of half blend and half sort of have a friction.
Sort of dissonance type thing, which, yeah, it's great.
We heard part of the Stabat Mater by Pergolesi, performed by James Bowman and Emma Kirkby, with the Academy of Ancient Music conducted by Christopher Hogwood. Brian Ferry, tell me a little bit about your early life. You grew up in the village of Washington outside Newcastle.
Yeah, sort of pit village.
And your father was a ploughman. It sounds very romantic, but it's very hard work.
He was brought up on a farm on the side of Penshaw Hill, which is this local landmark with a copy of a Greek Doric monument on top, called Penshaw Monument, and it's, you can see it from miles around. And he lived on a farm, and it was very primitive, no electricity.
So was he ploughing with a horse?
He loved horses, he ploughed with horses, And then a few years after he married my mother, she sort of dragged him a couple of miles away to the local village, Washington, where he could work with horses, but underground in the colliery there. So, yeah, he looked after the pit ponies. Mm. And he was a great gardener, and he didn't really listen to music at all. But he listened to nature, to birds. He was always out in the open growing amazing vegetables, like they do up there.
And your mother was quite outgoing, vivacious?
She was vivacious, Polly. Everybody seemed to like her, and full of life. And my dad was very quiet, and they were a very good combination, really. Yin and yang, you know.
And she would take you and your two sisters to the cinema?
Oh, yes, she made sandwiches and tea for the projectionists in the local cinema, which is kind of a bit like Cinema Paradiso, you know, that movie where the projectionists, you know, gave us all free seats. And they're kind of very hard seats, kind of wooden seats, but it was something, and that's where I saw my first films, which cunningly leads us to the next track, I think.
Yes, your next music comes from a film.
Yeah. I think it's amazing when music combines with strong visual images. This, it's a beautiful song, I think, and there have been so many great versions of Dancing in the Dark. This is the MGM Orchestra playing in the film The Bandwagon, starring the wonderful Fred Astaire and Sid Charisse. This wonderful scene in the movie where they're walking in Central Park and they're just getting to know each other, and they break into this most beautiful dance.
It's
one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen.
Every movement is so elegant, isn't it? Even when they're just walking on.
It's spellbinding. Yeah, start to finish, it's perfection, I think.
Thank you.
Dancing in the Dark from the 1953 film Bandwagon, performed by the MGM Studio Orchestra. Does that take you back to those hard benches?
It really does.
Did you respond also to the glamour of that? I mean, Astaire sported a natty pair of burgundy and white spectator derbies.
Yeah, he was always impeccably dressed, Astaire. And I actually like his voice as well as his great dancing. It was kind of soulful. I think he meant what he was singing, and I think he was aware that he didn't have the vocal equipment, but he made the most of it, and that's the great thing. It happens with a lot of singers I hear, it's the feeling that's the most important thing, I think.
Was there music at primary school?
Primary school? maybe the odd triangle one would hit or something. And we had to march into lessons to kind of Frederick Sousa type band music. So there were a lot of children, I think there were 50 in my class, and a wonderful teacher, Miss Swaddle, who was, we were all terrified of, but she was a marvellous teacher and very inspiring.
I think you used to earn money on a paper round, you would spend on records.
Yeah, that's right. First of all, there were 78s, and then I remember I saved up to buy my first EP. On the paper round, I used to deliver all the, as well as the newspapers, the music magazines, Melody Maker, which wrote about jazz and blues. I kind of became very keen on, and I read about this guy, Charlie Parker, and in the local record store at weekends, you'd select a record and ask if you could go and hear it in a booth, and I saved up, I think it was 11 and sixpence, to buy my first EP. It was called The Magnificent Charlie Parker, a great record. And I learned kind of every note of that record, played it again and again.
Well, it's Charlie Parker we're going to hear.
And so, he just amazed me with his virtuosity. He really excited me, and I thought, oh, this is incredible. And I still think it's incredible. I chose a track from Charlie Parker with strings, which some Charlie Parker purists didn't like that because he was with an orchestra. But it was one of his favourite records, and I love the counterpoint of this string section, very good players in New York, and him soaring over the strings with his saxophone. Just endlessly inventive, beautiful playing. Thank you.
pretty terrific, isn't it?
He never played a wrong note, Charlie Parker.
And he had some fantastic musicians as well as the strings, like yes. Buddy Rich on drums,
That's right. And Stan Freeman on piano. Yeah. Really great session players.
So that music really excited you. Make you think, I'd love to be doing something
the
like
energy
this?
That was so restless and kind of adventurous, and I loved it, and it was magical to me.
One way you were able, Brian Ferry, to sort of let off steam when you were young was cycling, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. I went through phases where I was really keen on one thing or another, and cycling, the Tour de France, I loved reading about that, and now I still, every year, watch it. It seems so exotic, cycling, international and glamorous to me.
And you had a job in a tailor's shop called Jackson's, didn't
you? I did, yeah, on the high street. It's all coming out now. I had to write down the measurements and sometimes advise people, and I was maybe 16, and advise them, you know, how their suit should look that they were ordering and stuff. It was fun.
Did you actually have to put a tape measure around people's waist?
No, I never got that
You weren't responsible enough for that, just writing it down.
No, I was just hireling. It's great when you're young to work with people and you meet all sorts of characters. And I used to work in the local steel factory as well in the summer, and that was fun as well. You know, they sort of send you to get a left-handed rake or something, you know, that's always being teased.
Do you think your love of tailoring and looking great came possibly from those days?
Well, it came from lots of things, from Charlie Parker. All the jazz players dressed great, very cool suits and ties and so on. Fred Astaire, of course, Gene Kelly, and all these great dancers in movies. And then all the film stars, they always wore good hats and suits and coats.
But, of course, this was at the time of Teddy Boys, wasn't it? Too?
It was, yeah. For a while, I hung out with a few at the local pool hall. Yeah, it was quite interesting. I saw so many different kinds of people growing up, you know. And then when I got to university, then I met other artists, people like myself who wanted to do creative things.
Until then, had you had many opportunities to see live music?
Yes. When I was 9, I saw Chris Barber's Jasmine, and he had a banjo player in his band called Lonnie Donegan, who popularized a lot of American blues music through skiffle. It was the skiffle phase. Songs like Rock Island Lion. Leadbelly was one of the great voices that I heard, with the yearning, a longing. It was haunting, like the first track we played here. It's haunting to me, and it takes you into another world, you know.
It's so interesting that the things that influenced you at this time ran on both tracks, as it were, the classical and the popular music. Because you saw your first opera when you were about 16.
Yeah, it might have been even a bit earlier. It was La Boheme at the Theatre Royal in Newcastle, and I went on my own. I seem to remember I was wearing a white trench coat. I think I was pretending I was Humphrey Bogart or something. And I remember being in tears. I was very moved by it, yeah. That was the moment. That was the first bit of classical music I'd ever seen. That was thrilling to me, you know.
Well, your next piece of music is also a tearjerker in some ways, because it comes from the four last songs by Richard Strauss.
It's Frühling, and it's a voice that I love, Elizabeth Schwarzkopf. I think she has a wonderful quality in her voice, and it's very authoritative, and there's a great kind of dignity in this music, I think. But it's swirling, it's got a lot of things going for it, and I think it's marvellous.
Thank you.
gorgeous, isn't it?
It's just a great last note, isn't it? Yeah.
It's almost like the equivalent in song of the elegance of Sid Charisse and Fred Astaire.
Yeah, it's all connected.
We heard Frühling, Spring, from the Four Last Songs by Richard Strauss, performed by the great Elisabeth Schwarzkopf with the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by the equally great George Sell. Brian Ferry, you loved art, history and literature, and while in the sixth form at Washington Grammar, I think you starred in a Shakespeare play.
Ah, I thought I'd buried that one. Yeah, I was Malvolio in Twelfth Night. Great starring moment for me. Yeah, it was very scary being on stage. I used to sometimes read in the annual carol service we'd have at the church as well, but being on stage and doing a soliloquy, it's just too scary for words. I don't understand how I ever did that.
Yeah, but on the other hand, maybe there was an element of the adrenaline that became addictive.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. And that was the first time, I guess, heard applause. And it's a good drug.
I think those of us that had the opportunity to do drama and things at school were lucky, really, because it does give you that experience.
Oh, yeah, right. Sometimes you have to be pushed into it, you know, and you need a teacher who's going to force you on and make you try, you know, and sometimes good things happen. I was very lucky to have great teachers, Mrs. Hope, the history teacher, and Mr. Oliver, the man who taught English. He was really good, and he'd been to Oxford, and he wore a gown, and he was quite proper and had a wonderful voice and encouraged us to try and speak with received pronunciation, which was the thing. And the teacher that took me under his wing was Bob Stapleton, the art teacher, and he really helped to prepare me to go to university to study art.
Now, I think there's a connection between your first band and your cycling, because one of the fellow cyclists was in the group.
Yes, that's how I started singing, yeah. He was in the cycling club I belonged to, and I said, "Oh, hi, how are you getting on?" You know, and he said, "Oh, yeah, I've got a band." I said, "Oh, really?" He said, "Oh, we're looking for a singer." And I said, "Oh, well, yeah, I can sing." So they were called the Banshees, and I went to his dad's hairdressing salon where they rehearsed, and in this room, extraordinary room surrounded by those old-fashioned hair dryers, you know, cowls, sort of, very sort of David Lynch looking. And I kind of passed the audition. And so instead of making, you know, I don't know, £5 a week, you know, I usually was working in the steel factory each summer, but this was the summer before I went up to college, you know. I was making £50 a week. It was incredible. It set me up to go to university. My first experience singing on stage.
Well, there can't be many people who've auditioned in a lady's hair salon.
No, I like to think it was a special moment.
You were quite a shy boy, and I wonder what...
Still am.
You know, whether it was that early drama that gave you the confidence to get up on the stage.
Yeah, it was a very unlikely job for me to be a singer in a band in the end. But, you know, needs must. And, I don't know, it seemed to work. I turned it into something.
What sort of songs were you singing?
Oh, Chuck Berry, that standard R&B things. Maybe the odd Beatles track, Jerry Lee Lewis or something. The next band, though, the band at college, it was much more sophisticated. We had a horn section and we did Bobby Bland songs, more obscure R&B tunes. That was pretty good.
Was this either City Blues or Gasport?
The Gasport. Yeah, the Gasport.
And the other members of that group included Mike Figgis, didn't they?
That's correct. At one time, just at the end, when I left to kind of concentrate on getting my degree, it seemed a very important thing to do in those days. And Graham Simpson was really important because he became the bass player in Roxy Music, the first incarnation of the band.
And you'd play at the club Go-Go in Newcastle.
Oh, yeah, that was a fantastic place in Percy Street where everybody went on a Thursday night. That was the hot spot in town. The local gangsters, all sorts of people. Oh, that was great. They played great music, perhaps a bit too upbeat for this show.
Oh, no, we embrace everything here.
I saw some great people there. And, we played there, the Gasport. We played there a few times. I remember seeing Wilson Pickett there, Captain Beefheart. It was a heady mixture, and there was an element of danger there, which was quite interesting.
Well, the next music you've chosen is a regular on Private Passions because it's that wonderful score for dance.
Yeah, well, I just thought something rhythmic, you know, and I don't go very often, but I like going to the ballet, Covent Garden, where they have great music, great dancing, choreography, the costume, the lighting, the sets. It's all combined to make magical moments, you know, and I've always liked that Dance of the Night from Romeo and Juliet. Prokofiev, and it's just stirring, and it's a good part of that show.
Thank you.
It's wonderful. Dance of the Nights from Romeo and Juliet. Terrific scoring by Prokofiev.
It's great, isn't it? It gets you going, doesn't it?
It's like a kind of monumental squeeze box.
And then the changes of key are kind of really cool.
We heard the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by Andrei Previn in the Dance of the Nights from Romeo and Juliet. In 1964, Brian Ferry, you went to Newcastle University to study art. Had that become a sort of passion for you?
Oh, yes, nurtured by the teacher at my school. He encouraged me to go to Newcastle, which he felt had a really good course. Also, there was a very well-known artist, Richard Hamilton, was teaching there, and so it was a very good moment. I met a lot of great people there.
Richard Hamilton was one of the first pop artists to achieve an almost iconic status. Do you remember him well?
Well, I was a bit in awe of him at the time. He was a very intellectual and charismatic figure, actually. You know, walk around the tutorials with a big cigar, and he had cool American clothes and a cool car, and his pictures that he was doing at that time, he was doing in one of the studios in the building. And so we were very inspired, you know, to have a famous artist working alongside us, as it were. He did a lot of his best work then in the mid-60s, I think. And there was a link through him to the other pop artists in America, and a couple of my friends went to New York, and one of them worked with Andy Warhol, screen printing some of those memorable images, you know, Marilyn Monroe and so on. Another one, Tim, worked with Klaus Oldenburg, the sculptor, and so they'd come back with tales of New York, and because we were very much, you know, into Americana and American culture, American artists and music, of course. And so it was a great time to be a student for me there.
I'm getting the sense in the late 60s that there was this freedom to escape the old school, the old world, and remake yourself.
That's right, yes. And the world was our oyster. I always thought I was going to be a painter, but I ended up, I think, trying to make pictures and music.
During this time at university, you hitched to a gig in London.
I did. It must have been 67. The Stax Review, which was Otis Redding, Sam and Dave, Arthur Conley, Eddie Floyd, all these great stars from the Stax label in Memphis. And their band was really wonderful. One singer after another came and performed with this band, each one more powerful than the next. It ended with Otis Redding striding across the stage, and it was overwhelming. It was really amazing for me to see all these great stars on stage. The music was fabulous, but they also presented it so beautifully and such energy and feeling. Everything about it was great. And I thought, I would like to do this.
Well, you did. The next track is another jazz one.
Yes, it's a great bit of singing by Johnny Hartman. He made this album with John Coltrane, and this is a track called My One and Only Love.
Thank you. makes my heart sing like an April breeze on the wings of spring, and you appear in all your splendor, my one and only love. The shadows fall and spread their mystic charms in the hush of night while you're in my arms. I feel your lips so warm and tender, my one and only love. The touch of your hand is like heaven, a heaven that I've never known. The blush on your cheek whenever I speak tells me that you are my own. You fill my eager heart with such desire. Every kiss you give sets my soul on fire. I give myself in sweet surrender, my one and only love, my one and only love.
You were talking earlier, Brian Ferry, about the mingling of voices when we were talking about James Bowman and Emma Kirkby. Yeah. And there we had that wonderful tenor sax mingling with that extraordinary voice of Johnny Hartman.
It's great, isn't it? it's a very mellow thing they do together.
It's so texturally delighted.
So much space around what they're doing, which I think sounds great.
You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest this week is the singer-songwriter Brian Ferry. In 1968, Brian, you moved to London, where you had a number of different jobs while trying to break into music. Pottery teacher was one.
I fell into that by accident, really, because I was doing some supply teaching, and one of the schools, they said, oh, would you like to do a couple of days here teaching ceramics? And I said, oh, sure. And it was very handy, the school, because it was only about 5 minutes' walk from where I was living in Kensington High Street. So I got this book called Teach Yourself Pottery, and I sort of thumbed through it, and before each day I'd sort of go in there and I used to take some records in, actually, and play to the kids, and we had such a good atmosphere there, and I just let them get on doing whatever they could do with clay, and it was quite interesting. I ended up doing some tiny sculptures, actually, which I glaze, which are much prized.
Do you still have them?
I still have them, yeah. A couple of my friends have some as well. And so I try to make the most of it, you know, get something out of it and put something into it.
You were about to found Roxy Music. Where did the name come from?
We sort of made a list of names of cinemas, because I liked the fact that there were picture palaces, you know, a house of dreams kind of thing. And the names that didn't really mean anything, like Esoldo or Odeon, Gaumont, Stoll, Roxy. And we said, oh, Roxy, that's a good name. Let's use that. And it worked.
So you had Graham Simpson from the College Band, and then Andy Mackay joined, and he was an oboe player. That was quite unusual.
Well, that was a great thing, and I met him through a friend of mine, The one who'd worked for Klaus Oldenburg, actually, in New York. Tim is a good artist. I said, I'm making songs, and do you know anyone who has a synthesizer? Because I really want to use electronics in the band. And he said, yes, this guy, Andy Mackay, who plays oboe, and he's got a synth. That's how I met Andy. He came as a synth player with an oboe, and he also had a saxophone. And so after a few weeks or months of this, he said, hey, well, we'd like to record this. But he didn't have a tape recorder, and cassettes hadn't been invented at that point. Andy said, well, I know this guy who has a big proper tape recorder, you know, and he's called Brian Eno. And so Brian Eno came along to record us, and he sort of saw Andy's synth, and he really liked what we were doing, and he joined. It was very fortuitous that we didn't have a tape recorder. That's how we met Brian. And then Phil Manzanera joined after that, and Paul Thompson, of course, a great drummer, the beat of the band.
And you recorded your first demos in, I think, May of 1971, and sent them to Richard Williams, to Melody
That's
Maker.
Right. Yeah, because I thought he was a good writer, and I liked his taste, I liked what he wrote, and I thought, well, if anyone's going to like this, it'll be this guy. And he called me that day and said, oh, I really like this, I'd like to meet you, and he wrote a piece about what we were doing, and it all went from there.
Your eponymous first album was released in 1972. Mm. What were you, in a nutshell, trying to do with those first tracks? Did you have a clear idea,
no,
or did it just
really
come together?
We were sort of making it up as we went along, really, and just wanted to do something that was all-embracing and obviously related to different kinds of music that had gone before. I don't know, I wanted it to be kind of serious and yet fun, to have beat and have melody and be sort of emotional, you know, to have feeling. And having all those instruments at our disposal made it more colourful, you know, oboe, saxophone, great guitar sounds, and, of course, electronic variations of these instruments.
Certainly rhythmic.
And rhythmic as well, yes.
I was thinking of Virginia Plain on Top of the Pops, and
oh,
it's
yeah.
basically, it's two chords, isn't
it's
it?
Two, yeah, it's just banging on me.
Yeah, one and five, and then a sort of 120, bum, 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 bum,
yeah,
bum, bum,
right.
bum, with you
yeah.
playing the upright piano.
Yeah, yeah, I always played in fifths, and it was all very, very basic, and my playing was really appalling, but it worked.
Your next choice, Brian, has rather more than two chords.
Yes, I don't think I could ever play that. But at some point, I started spending a lot of time in Sussex, very close to where Elgar worked and where he wrote this piece, maybe a mile from where I've lived ever since. And I'm kind of in London most of the time, and it's a great place to make music. But I like to retreat to the countryside to get a bit of nature when I can. And this cello concerto, it reminds me of the fields and the woods and my neighbourhood.
Music from the first movement of the Cello Concerto in E minor by Edward Elgar, performed by Jacqueline Dupré, with the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by Sir John Barbirolli.
Stirring stuff, isn't it?
It's incredible. Yeah, when they get right up to that high note, both on the cello and on the orchestra, it's overpowering.
Yeah. Film of her playing it. She's so inside the music.
Absolutely. Your cover art often features models. Carrie Ann Moller appeared on the first, and Jerry Hall, who you then dated, appeared on the fifth album, Siren.
Yeah, yeah.
Why do you think having models instead of the band worked so well?
Well, we preferred being behind the camera than in front of it. We thought, let's have something beautiful on the cover, not just the band standing in a kind of dark alley or cobble street, which was the vogue, really, at the time. Yeah, so it seemed to work. It seemed to go with the music. There was something about the visual sensibility matched the musical sensibility.
Actually, you brought in a fashion designer, Anthony Price.
Oh, yes. I'd met this guy, Anthony Price, who was a star graduate of the Royal College of Art Fashion School, at a party, actually. And he became a great friend subsequently and helped with all the early album covers. And when I was young, I had this LP called The Romantic Music of Tchaikovsky. On the cover was a beautiful woman. Not many people know this. that was a kind of inspiration, I think, for the first album cover. I must have shown this picture to Anthony Price. Anyway, Anthony made this outfit for Carrie Ann. Mm. It has the same colour, tonality.
More jazz now.
I think I said that the first concert I went to was Chris Barber's jazz band, and this is essentially Chris Barber's jazz band with Ken Collier leading it on this record, the trumpet player. He'd gone to New Orleans to work, and when he came back, he was feted by the trad jazz world as having, you know, really lived the life out there. And they did this record, which I really like it. There was a great clarinet player called Monty Sunshine. He plays in this. And Chris Barber on trombone and Ken Collier on trumpet. It's the first time I heard my name on the radio was through this record. I requested it on a radio show, and they played the record for me. Yeah, my name on the radio. I couldn't believe it.
Well, and probably in due course, your name appeared when people requested yours.
Sing it again.
Here it is. It's called Going Home.
I'm leaving here today. 'Cause if I don't leave now, I won't be going nowhere. Where you from? Where you from? Won't you tell me? Tell me before I'm gone. 'Cause if I don't leave now, I won't be going nowhere. What you say and what you do, well, it's tight like this, and I'm telling you that if I don't leave now, I won't be going nowhere. Well, if home is where the heart is, and my home's in New Orleans, well, take me to that land of dreams. And if I don't leave now, I won't be gone nowhere.
like the way they all bounce off each other. Don't
yeah,
you?
Wonderful. Going Home, composed by Ken Collier and performed by Ken Collier's Jazz Men. Brian Ferry, alongside your career with Roxy Music, you established a solo career and began making covers of music that you admired. Why did you want to do that in particular?
It was quite simple, really. After the second Roxy album, I just wanted to make another album straight away. I really loved the process of making the second album. It's when we really started feeling our way around the studio and, you know, trying to figure out how to make a record, you know, to construct a record. I was so enamoured of the process. I just wanted to make another record straight away, but I didn't have any more songs left over from the second album. So I, with John Porter, who played in the band Roxy on the second album, the bass player, I said, well, let's make a record of covers, rather like an old album of Elvis Presley or Frank Sinatra or Bing Crosby or Billie Holiday, my favourite singer probably. They weren't songwriters, but they sang covers of existing songs. And so I chose a dozen songs. One of them was the title track, These Foolish Things, which is an old, you know, song from the 30s. Mm. And the other things are from the 50s and 60s. It was a holiday away from my writing then. And the first track we did that we cut was probably the best cover I've ever done. It's called Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, Bob Dylan. And we did it with a lot of enthusiasm.
Well, you went on to bring out an entire album of Dylan in 2007 called Dylanesque. Mm-hmm. So he's obviously quite an important figure for you.
Oh, he's a great lyricist, you know, wonderful words and great imagery. And there's a lot of feeling in his writing, imagination, you know. As a singer, you want to sing good words, and there are plenty there.
How did your parents take to your success? What did they make of it?
Oh, they were thrilled, yeah. They couldn't really believe it, because they were very humble, quiet folk, and the idea of somebody, you know, sort of being in the public eye was kind of a bit weird. Mm. And they were thrilled, because they wanted me to have a better life.
How do you set about writing your own material? Does it come as a process of jamming or what?
No. It usually starts on my own, probably in the evening, night, you know, on the piano. I don't play that often. When I do play, then it feels like a treat to me. And then the germ of a song will come out of that, and then I'll listen to it sometime later, maybe years later, on a cassette or whatever, and then say, maybe I can turn this into something and take it to the studio and start interacting with other players.
Kurt Weill next.
I like his music very much. One of my favourite European singers was Lottie Lenya, his wife, singing Kurt Weill. But this is different. This is Walter Houston, the actor, father of John Houston, the great film director. And the lyrics were Maxwell Anderson, September Song.
When I was a young man courting the girls, I played me a waiting game. If a maid refused me with tossing curls, I'd let the old earth take a couple of whirls while I plied her with tears in place of pearls. And as time came around, she came my way. As time came around, she came. But it's a long, long while from May to December. And the days grow short when you reach September. And the autumn weather turns the leaves to flame. And I haven't got time for the waiting game. And the wine dwindles down to a precious brew. September, November, and these few vintage years I'd share with you. These vintage years dreams I'd share with you. But it's a long, long while from May to December, and the days grow short when you reach September. And I have lost one too, and I walk a little lame, and I haven't got time for the waiting game. And the days turn to gold as they grow few, September, November. And these few golden days I'd spend with you, these golden days I'd spend with you. When you meet with the young men early in spring, they court you in song and rhyme, they woo you with words and a clover ring. But if you examine the goods they bring, they have little to offer but the songs they sing, and a plentiful waste of time of day, a plentiful waste of time. But it's a long, long while from May to December. Will the clover ring last till you reach September? And I'm not quite equipped for the waiting game, but I have a little money and I have a little fame. And the days dwindle down to a precious few, September, November. And these few precious days I'd spend with you, these precious days I'd spend with you.
September Song, composed by Kurt Weill for the 1938 musical Knickerbocker Holiday and performed there by Walter Houston. Brian Ferry Roxy music split up in 1982. Was that a natural evolution or a very painful process?
Well, we'd made our most successful album, in fact, Avalon, and then we did a long tour. And after that, I kind of didn't do any more band records. By then, I was working with so many different people that it seemed natural to just amalgamate the two careers. And so Boys and Girls was a solo record, although it followed in this stylistically very much in the Avalon mode.
One of the constant themes in your music, and indeed in most popular music, is love and its costs, viewed from different angles. Mm-hmm. And you certainly had your share of difficult times, haven't you, as we all do?
Well, music, it's a universal language, romance and music. And I guess the music I do tends to be more one-to-one. It's not me kind of shouting from the rooftops type music. It's it's more intimate than that, I think. And I tend to like the reflective stuff, and it's kind of, one-to-one.
This feeling of tragedy enveloping one is very much suggested by the next music, which is Mahler's Kinder Totenlieder, songs about the loss of children. And in fact, his wife was so worried about him setting it that she thought he was tempting fate.
It's very, very soulful music, and I wish I knew more about Mahler, but I intend to try and discover more as I get older. There are certain composers who have a melodic flair that speaks to me, and there's a certain kind of yearning in their music which I like very much.
Now the sun is about to rise as brightly as if no misfortune had happened in the night. There's such a sense of longing and yearning in those long lines, especially as sung there by Janet Baker.
Beautiful voice, no? Yeah, great.
That was the first of Mahler's Kindertotenlieder, performed, as I said, by Janet Baker with the Halle Orchestra, conducted once again by Sir John Barbirolli. Brian, in 2022, you reunited with Roxy Music for the 50th anniversary tour. Was it fun to get back on stage with your old mates?
Yeah, terrific. It was great. And yeah, I wish we could have done more dates. We did a tour in America and then 3 dates here in the UK. And I enjoyed it very much. It was great to have play those songs with some of the original guys. The audience was marvellous, and it was quite moving to reunite for that.
For your retrospective album, you've collaborated with the poet Amelia Barrett on a dance track called Star. Is working with younger people fascinating now?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Energising. And I love the enthusiasm. The new work with Amelia Barrett, the writer, well, she's an artist who writes beautifully. It's been great. The last couple of years, actually, we've been collaborating on these things which will see the light of day next year. And, yeah, it's exciting for me to work with young talent like that.
Sadly, we have to come to your final piece, Brian Ferry.
Oh, yes.
So what is it?
Well, I like the sound of the guitar very much, and I've worked with lots of great guitar heroes and some unsung heroes, but this is a master of the instrument. It's Django Reinhardt, and I'll see you in my dreams.
Very influential guitarist. Because of him, the Julian Bream really took up the guitar.
Oh, really? No.
Yeah.
No.
And he always said to me, amazing that this man had his hand so badly burnt in
that's
an accident
right.
that
yeah,
two
yeah.
fingers didn't work.
Incredible. You know, so it's just a man who totally mastered his instrument and played such beautiful lyrical lines. And this is a beautiful song, and it's very romantic.
I'll see you in my dreams. Brian Ferry, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
See You in My Dreams by Django Reinhardt, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on today's Private Passions, Brian Ferry, co-founder of Roxy Music. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. Next week, Michael is talking to the space scientist Dame Maggie Aderin-Pocock.
Step into an entire day of dance this Friday here on BBC Radio 3.
From ballet to Bhangra, gavottes to waltzes, tarantellas to tangos.
Join Petroc Trelawney and Darcy Bustle for a dance-inspired breakfast. Take a whirl around the world through the music of ballroom dancing for Composer of the Week.
And for the finale, join me, Craig Revel-Horwood and Katie Durham for show-stopping Friday night is music night.
Radio 3's Day of Dance. Listen this Friday morning from 6:30 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
Hello from me, John Shea. I'm with you for the rest of the day here on Radio 3. It's 100 years ago tomorrow since Gabriel Fauré died. The pianist Catherine Stott is currently preparing to step down from the concert platform, and in our Sunday feature this evening, she takes a personal look at a composer whose music has been central to her career. Fauré and me at 7:15 this evening. And if Fauré is a favourite composer of yours too, then stay tuned to Radio 3 right now for this week's Music Map. Our tour guide, as ever, is Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, the show where we fix our eyes and ears on the horizon, plotting our way through a landscape of sound from across the ages to reach our musical destination. And today, we're finding our way towards a 19th century French drawing room. Seated at the piano, the middle-aged composer Gabriel Fauré, mustachioed and kindly, and next to him, the daughter of his mistress, Emma Bardach. Her name is Dolly, and together they're playing a suite of six duets which he's written for her. Well, this isn't actually a recording of them, but at least it is a family duo, the sisters Katia and Marielle Lebec, who we'll hear playing the whole of Fauré's Dolly suite at the end of today's show. As we make our way there, we'll be listening into music written for and performed by families. We'll hear the sounds of childhood reimagined by composers and eavesdrop on lullabies and waltzes. But let's start where you might have heard the Dolly suite before. For years, it was the unmistakable theme tune to BBC Radio's Listen with Mother. So let's start with another much-loved BBC Radio theme.